So this evening I'm going to talk a little bit about the bodhicitta, which is partly because we've noticed that on the retreats we sort of dive straight into the bodhicitta and it can become quite heady. It's like, you know, you start right up there and then kind of go into practice. And sometimes people can feel a little bit lost. Yeah, so we're going to start with the bodhicitta and I'll just say a few of my own personal reflections about it. Particularly, I've just come back from a solitary retreat, and these were the things that I was thinking about on the solitary retreat. I do tend to be concerned about the bodhicitta in myself. I kind of think, what am I doing to cultivate the bodhicitta? It's sort of a pressing issue in my mind. Anyway, so and one thing I notice is that people can end up when they're just talking about the bodhicitta, as opposed to sort of the practices behind developing the bodhicitta, cultivating the bodhicitta, is people can get very, very confused and as to what the bodhicitta is and how to develop it. And I've been writing a course on Dr. Abhyanga, as Charlotte knows, because she's been teasing me about it today. I've been saying that for a long time, so I still haven't finished it. So I've written it, and then I asked a few people for feedback, and one of the people, actually I think it was the only person who gave me feedback, was Subhuti. And there's a bit in it where I just try and sort of summarise what the bodhicitta is fairly quickly, because it's a course about Dr. Abhyanga, and I don't want to go endlessly into the bodhicitta. People have already studied it and things like that. Anyway, I've got this paragraph about sort of summarising the bodhicitta. And Subhuti just said, yes, I don't know where you're going with this. It's just full of jargon. It needs a complete rewrite. went back and looked at it and I thought, my goodness, he's right. What are you talking about? It's a complete garbled mess, you know. The niyamas, I didn't know what I was saying. Anyway, so I just had to delete the whole thing of that paragraph and just start again. And I was thinking about it. I was thinking, well, in a way, it's because at the heart of the bodhicitta is a paradox. That's what makes it a bit confusing. It's an experience that's beyond the individual. It's beyond your own self-clinging. Sort of feeling that it's described as this feeling as if a force is working through you for the benefit of all. So it's sort of beyond self-clinging. It's a force that's working through you. In a way, it's not you, and yet it is you. Mm-hmm. So it's beyond, as Shantideva talks about it in the Bodhicaryavatara, he says, where it's beyond even ordinary goodness. He says, at night in darkness, thick with clouds, a lightning flash gives a moment's brightness. So sometime by the power of the Buddha, the worldly mind might for a moment turn to skillful intentions. But the power of good is weak, while the power of darkness is vast and terrible. What other good could conquer that were there not the bodhicitta? So the power of good is weak, you know, the mind might sometimes turn to skillful intentions. But the power of good is weak. And the power of darkness is vast and terrible. And the only thing that can really conquer that is the bodhicitta, which is beyond goodness. It's something more than skillful intentions. As Nagarjuna said, it's outside of the five skandhas, which means it's outside ordinary human experience. It's other in a way. And yet, at the same time, it arises in the individual on the basis of developing faith and compassion and wisdom. So Shantideva also says, just like a blind man who by chance finds a jewel in a heap of rubbish, so by some chance the bodhicitta has arisen in me. So it's other, it's beyond goodness, it's a transcendental experience beyond the five skandhas, and yet arises in me. And it doesn't arise in me by a total accident. It will arise in me if I've cultivated certain qualities of mind, certain states of consciousness. And I think the problem about it is because it's got it at this heart, a paradox, we can get into confusion, because if we focus it on it too much as a sort of transcendental experience beyond the self and outside the skandhas, it becomes so far away, it's nothing we could ever attain. It's nothing that we're kind of in relationship with, if you like. And then it becomes just about, you know, some gurus in ancient Tibet. You know, they've got the bodhicitta, or archetypal figures. But it's always so far away. One can't conceive of oneself ever really, it arising in oneself, or ever having a kind of relationship with it. And it becomes an exotic dream. Whereas if we focus, so, you know, we try then talk about it, oh, like, well, what are your experiences of that opening out beyond self-clinging? You had an experience perhaps in the collective where you feel like something's come into being that's sort of bigger than the sum of its parts. But if we focus it too much on that, then we also tend to, we can also dumb it down a bit. We forget that it is actually more than goodness. We forget it's more than skillful intentions. We can tone it down to just an ordinary experience of connectedness. And we miss out, I suppose, on its full potential. So there's always these ways we're talking about it, that we need to bring in both aspects. That yes, it is outside the skandhas, it's a transcendental experience, it's completely beyond self-clinging. And in that sense, it's sort of beyond experience as we know it. And yet, it also arises within individuals. Sangharakshita says more likely to arise in a collective context. And it's possible. It's possible for us. It's possible within our spiritual community. What we tend to do is we sort of oscillate between the two. Mm-hmm. You know, it's these experiences of connectedness, or it's just like this really outside other experience. So yes, so how do we bring together both perspectives? Sangharakshita talks about these two perspectives. He talks about binocular vision. In a way, we need both at the same time before we can break through the dichotomy, basically. There's also a lovely poem by Wallace Stevens, where he talks about beyond us yet ourselves. So I quite like that expression. It's sort of got to be holding that it's beyond us and yet it is us. So the way that I thought I'd talk about how to keep those two perspectives and how to develop the bodhicitta is to talk about the three myths of the spiritual life, which you may have come across before. So that's the three myths of the spiritual life are self-development, self-discovery, and self-surrender. One of the things that's important is that they are myths, you know, not to take them too literally. So I'll keep saying that as I go along. It's just different ways of imagining the path and the goal. So what we've got is the first one is we've got the myth of self-development. So that's me. And I'm trying to develop the bodhicitta. Just to clarify what that diagram might be about. Me, bodhicitta. So in the myth of self-development, what we do is to get from me and my deluded mind to the bodhicitta.
So you've got a stick figure then and a big bean.
And a big bean, yeah. Is that I have to go on a path. So there's a path that leads from me to be. Okay, that's a not a highly complicated diagram. There's a stick figure, which is me. There's a big B, which is the bodhicitta. And there's a little line going between the two. This diagram will fill out. So what we've got there is the path from me, my deluded consciousness, fairly self-absorbed, to the bodhicitta is a path, and traditionally that would be the path of the paramitas, the path of the perfections. And the way that Bhante talks about the perfections is this interesting. He sort of puts them in pairs as a sort of tension between two, a creative tension between two sort of forces or energies, if you like. So he talks about it mainly as a tension between withdrawal and engagement, or wisdom and compassion. So what he does is he sort of evokes these two moods or motivations that, in order to develop the bodhicitta, we have to develop. We've got to get sort of cultivate, in a way, both these moods, both these motivations. So the first one is withdrawal, which is one reflects on dukkha and the unsatisfactory of conditioned existence, and that sets up the longing to transcend the sufferings of conditioned existence. So what you do is you reflect on that life is inherently unsatisfactory, that there exists unsatisfactoriness on all levels. So traditionally you'd have the level of dukkha, which would be actual physical and mental experience of dukkha, the dukkha of change, so that everything that you hold on to, you can't hold on to ever, forever, everything is always changing. One is separated from what one loves, is united with things that one does not love. You can't hold the world. I mean, the Buddha evokes this very, very beautifully when he starts talking about it. He says, well, I long to find myself a place of a stability, of solidness, of kind of home. And I couldn't find it because there's nothing in the world that's stable. Mm-hmm. Everything is always moving. And there's also the dukkha of dukkha of existence itself, that even if you could, even if it were possible, which is not, but even if it was possible to rearrange the world to suit oneself and one's own desires, it would miss out on the desire for enlightenment. In a way, it's not enough for human beings just to have pleasure. we have this sort of innate sense that we can be something more than that. So in a way, what you've got is you've got this experience of dukkha, that life cannot satisfy us on its own level. We can't always get what we want. It's unstable, it's dukkha, it's devoid of inherent selfhood. And what this does is you're seeing into the nature of life, and you're seeing into the lakshanas, the marks of conditioned existence. And this leads you to develop wisdom and withdraw from the world, withdraw from those kind of worldly concerns, because they're inherently unsatisfactory. And I was thinking about this on my solitary retreat, and I was thinking, oh, it's interesting, because we don't usually think of wisdom as withdrawal. Because withdrawal implies turning away from life. And we usually think of wisdom as turning towards life, as turning towards the way things are, examining the way things are, reflecting on the way things are. So the way that I think why Bhante brings in the word withdrawal at this point is to highlight a certain aspect of wisdom. Because what is needed for wisdom to emerge is stillness. The way the Buddha talked about it, he said, the monk must look for peace within himself and not in any other place. For when a person is inwardly quiet, there is nowhere a self can be found. Where then could a non-self be found? So the Buddha makes this relationship very, very clear. If you want to see into the nature of existence, one has to withdraw from... one has to look for peace within oneself and not in external objects. Because in a sense, where else are we going to find it? Where else are we going to find wisdom? What's interesting about the myth of Avalokiteshvara, and often people miss this bit out of the story, is that Avalokiteshvara is a renunciant. He's depicted wearing the skin of an antelope, which is the traditional symbol of a renunciant. And he goes to the Potala mountain to go into solitary retreat, to enter into the samadhi of liberating all beings. So the whole myth is set up with actually him withdrawing, actually having that withdrawal. I'm really working on his mind. And I've been looking a little bit into the origin of the Bodhisattva ideal, because now we're living in a very fortunate time where more of the early sutras have been translated into English. And the origin of the Bodhisattva ideal is becoming more clear. What is becoming clearer was within Indian monasteries, what you'd get is you'd get the kind of, I can't think of a very, well, the sort of hardcore. There was a kind of group of monks within the Indian monasteries who were really wanting to develop Samyak Sambodhi for all beings, develop the perfection so that they could be a Buddha in future times, when there was no Buddhas. They were going to train themselves so that they could rise in a Buddha at a time when there are no Buddhas. So the Bodhisattva, people on the Bodhisattva path, the Bodhisattva Jnana, they were like specialists in the Mahayana sutras, and undertook a very, very strict regime of renunciation and study and practice, because they had to develop the 10 perfections, or the 6 perfections, or the 10 perfections. They had to develop this path so that they could be a full Buddha in future time. It was a very, very specialist, very difficult path, that the emphasis was on being a forest dweller and a renunciant and spending a long time in solitary retreat and study. So that's one part of it. If we're really going to develop wisdom, there has to be an element of stilling the mind and looking into the nature of mind. And one can't do that if one's mind is always turning towards external objects for satisfaction. So I think it's interesting that Sangharaksha talks so much about withdrawal as wisdom, because there's an element of actual renunciation. It doesn't mean that, you know, we're all going to be forest dwellers, although hopefully some of us will. Where's Val? You know, we don't all have to be forest dwellers, but we have to really reflect on where that element of withdrawal is coming in our lives. You know, how much we just invested in externals and external objects, and how much is actually looking for peace within ourselves. Because then you'll find the self and no self. You know, the monk must look for peace within himself and not in any other place. For when a person is inwardly quiet, there is nowhere a self can be found. Where then can a non-self be found? So wisdom comes from looking inwards, in being inwardly quiet. But then you've also got this trend of engagement, because of course one can see dukkha for oneself, you know, that it's... The world cannot give us lasting satisfaction. Not the world. Grasping after things, grasping after external objects, cannot give us lasting satisfaction. And you can see the dukkha of delusion. You know, it's very, very painful to see one's own negative mental states, deluded mental states. They cause us such suffering. But we can also see that as we're seeing that for ourselves, so it is true for other beings. And we also focus on the fact that other beings are also subject to dukkha. They're also subject to delusion. Mm. So bodhicitta practices bring in those two elements. You've got an understanding of dukkha for yourself and the desire to renounce, in a way, ordinary deluded consciousness, ultimately. But also a desire to liberate others from that dukkha. There's a really beautiful beautiful line, which I often come back to, particularly when I'm engaging in practice, bodhicitta practices. which is when the Parinibbana Sutta, where the Buddha was just talking to some of the monks, and he knew he was going to die. He's an old man, he's been enlightened for a long time, he's about to enter into his Parinibbana. And he says, it's through not understanding, through not penetrating the Four Noble Truths, have we run on and wandered round this long, long journey, both you and I. What an extraordinary moment. What an extraordinary moment. The Buddha, the Samyak Sambuddha, who was enlightened, could say that with such tenderness to his disciples. You know, both you and I. We've run on and wandered round this long, long journey, both you and I. You know, that he could see that even within the midst of his own enlightenment. He could see about this journey that we're all undergoing, and how through not understanding the nature of reality, through not understanding the nature of suffering, we continue to suffer. There's lines in the Bodhicaryavatara, hoping to escape suffering, it is to suffering they run. And we're all doing it. It's not even the Buddha didn't say, well, you people are doing that. Even though he knew he was free, he knew he was, he knew he was free. He could still say that, both you and I. He knows that journey because he was doing it for aeons, you know. So, yeah, so you engage back with the world, seeing that, what suffering, what are we doing? Hoping to escape suffering, it is to suffering we run. We don't understand ourselves. As Pablo Neruda says, you know, it's this sort of sadness of not understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. You know, why do we do this? So there's that kind of tender reaching out towards other beings. And I was thinking about these kind of two movements in a way, the sort of movement of withdrawal and the movement of engagement. I was watching that in my mind during my solitary retreat, and I thought, I can see what these moods are doing, because basically what we ordinarily do is we engage with the world in a relationship of grasping. So this is the deluded consciousness separates itself from others. And so there's myself is the subjective pole of my experience, and others is the bit that I can't control, is the objective pole of my experience. And what happens is I try and grasp after things outside of my experience that I like, and push away the part of things that I don't like. So I'm in this relationship of grasping and aversion the whole time to the world. And that's all that's going on in my consciousness, in a way, all the time. It's sort of, what is in this for me? What is in this for me all the time? This is the kind of grasping and grasp and grasped. What can I have? What can I push away? What's sometimes called the ego project. How can I bolster my sense of selfhood up in relation to the world? So that's our deluded consciousness, and we've got to retrain that in order to cultivate the bodhicitta. So how we retrain that is, instead of just relating to the world on the basis of grasping all the time, we kind of pull it back. That's withdrawal. We're sort of pulling it back and looking into the nature of mind itself. And just staying still. Just staying still. Just experiencing, trying to have sort of full experience without grasping. And you know, some of you have had that for a period of time, you know, particularly on retreat. I think this is where we get our main experience of withdrawal in this sense. And it's so pleasant. You know, I was just watching, I was on the solitary retreat, and I spent, I don't know how long, just watching a bee wash itself. Oh, it was such a relief. You know, it wasn't in like, oh, is, you know, what's in this bee for me? Oh, I need to be getting on with something else. Da 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 da. But it's, you know, I'm being lazy watching a bee, or, you know, all of that stuff kind of goes. You're just watching a bee wash itself. There's just experience as it is without that kind of grasping or aversion. I don't care whether I like bees or not. It's completely irrelevant information. Just watch the bee washing itself. How extraordinary. So I think what happens is the first sort of, there's part of the bodhicitta which is about actually just getting out of that game of grasper and grasped. Leave that game behind. Leave that tension behind, that sort of stress of being, which is always trying to look in the world for what's in it for me. And that mind that always reaches beyond itself to sort of fill itself, is always looking for external objects to fill itself. So just stop it. You know, that's what you're doing first of all, is just stopping that kind of game, that reactive mind. Because there's no freedom in it. We're constantly compelled to act because we're grasping after an object to reinforce our own identity, basically. That's what's going on. So we're always grasping after an object. And it's painful, and it's stressful, and it's tension. And it's compulsion. Somewhere Bhante says something about samsara is simply the attitude of compulsion. You know, we're compelled to act in certain ways because we can't just rest within ourselves. So withdrawal, in withdrawal, there's no compulsion outside. That part of that quote is, so we've got the monk must look for peace within himself and not in any other place, for when a person is inwardly quiet, there is nowhere a self can be found. Where then could a non-self be found? And then he says, there are no waves in the depths of the sea. It is still unbroken. It is the same with the monk. He is still, without a quiver of desire, without a remnant on which to build pride or desire. So there's a relationship there with, if you look, if you're inwardly quiet, you see there's nowhere a self can be found. Where then could a non-self be found? And then you become so still, you're like the waves in the depths of the sea. I find it extraordinary the Buddha said that, because he's never actually been to the sea as far as we know. He definitely hadn't been diving. But anyway. In the depths of the sea, it is still unbroken. You can imagine, you know, that's that piece of, you ever actually have been snorkeling and you're on a coral reef or something and you come to the end. Without a quiver of desire, so subtle, isn't it? There's a quiver of, and that's the mind just wanting to go whoop, to grab something. There's not even a quiver of desire. Without a remnant on which to build pride or desire. So that's withdrawal, that's what you're aiming for. Complete freedom of mind. Because if we're talking about freedom, we have to get a sense of what we're being free from and free to. We're freeing ourselves from something, what the deluded consciousness is really like. And we're freeing ourselves to something else, what a liberated consciousness looks like. Beyond self-clinging or object-clinging, freedom from delusion or grasping. And freedom to this still sort of deep state of mind. But of course you can't rest there. You can't just rest in the depths of the sea. You turn then the consciousness as consciousness is still and deep without a remnant on which to build pride, desire, without a compulsion towards samsara, then moves out to others. So this is what it's talking about. It's like you move out to others again, but not from compulsion and not from grasping. And I think in a way this is the essence of why the bodhicitta is the bodhicitta and not skillful activity. Because if we don't get that withdrawal, we're relating to the bodhisattva vow on the basis of compulsive activity, which usually means a basis of insecurity in oneself. So, we're using the bodhisattva ideal and compassion towards others to sort of fill an empty hole in ourselves, to create a sense of identity from ourselves. And then, as we know, it can go a little wrong. It's an alright place to start. You know, one can't just wait for the pure motivation to start acting altruistically. But it's more like, this is what we're actually trying to do. Don't finish there. It's a great place to start, a terrible place to finish compulsive activity towards helping other people. It's better than being totally selfish, but what we're actually trying to do is help people from this state of mind, which is still and deep. Because otherwise we're still operating in a delusory framework of grasp and grasped, and what we'll do is we'll end up grasping other people by wanting to help them. So that's why, I suppose coming back to it, that's why withdrawal is so important as one of these kind of moods, if one likes, why withdrawal is so necessary, and why, if one goes on retreat, one shouldn't feel selfish. It is in line with the Bodhisattva ideal, because what you're trying to cultivate is a still, deep state of mind in which you can be able to help others more effectively. So, yes, the consciousness reaches out to external objects, pulls itself back, reaches out again, but from a completely different basis. And one needs experience of both, the stillness and the reaching out again from a different basis. And what a gift that would be. You know, what a gift it would be. When I recite that line, there are no waves in the depths of the sea, it is still unbroken. I heard some sighs of like, God, that's so beautiful, isn't it? Well, what if we could give each other that? What if we could be like that deep, deep sort of unbroken sea for each other? What a gift would be to give someone peace, you know? We think of giving usually as rushing around and helping people. But actually, it doesn't have to be like that. I mean, there was one part where I don't know if I put it in this material, but Sangha actually talks about the importance of having someone around the centre who's got an unspecified role. So you need someone around the centre who's not rushing around doing loads of stuff, actually, who's just there to just be with people and give them undivided attention. What about, what would it be like if we were truly present with ourselves and able to give from that? Actually, I do the White Tara practice, and that's definitely what she embodies for me. Completely still within herself. Her foot's not even out, actually. Just one hand. But still, coming from a place of still and the three refuges at her heart. And it's a quality of the Buddha. He stands within himself. Said. So yeah, so that's just a bit more of a flavour of those two trends of withdrawal and engagement. But it's that's one myth, that's self-development. We develop both those strands intensely at the same time, engagement and withdrawal. But there are other ways of looking at it. Coming back to the diagram. So this is self-discovery. We're on a self-development. It's going on a path from me to be. But there's also self-discovery, which is realizing that B is in me all the time. I draw a B on my beautiful stick figure. There's a bodhicitta. It was there all the time.
In your tummy.
In your tummy. Like a jewel in a dung heap.
What was that called again?
Self-development. No, self-discovery. Bad you're all involved. So the way I was thinking about this is if you read Available in the Bookshop for a Small Sum, is Bhante's new books on with his seminars on the Milarepa Sutra, Milarepa songs. So I was reading that in my solitary. And Bhante talks about that is patterns, seeing a pattern in one's life. Seeing a pattern in words in one's life. And I think this is really about sort of the self-discovery. And what he says in that is that you, after a time when you're reflecting on your life, when you're seeing how your life develops, you see a pattern emerging of your life. Actually, I think it's sometimes you see the pattern of your life by seeing what it isn't, not just what it is. So I remember for me, there was a very strong experience of my partner at the time was building yurts and staying with a man who lived in the woods in a yurt who just got a new baby. And there was this moment, I don't know if this is what my partner was thinking, but he looked at me in this particular way where I thought, ah, this is what you want. You want to live in a yurt in the woods and for me to have a baby and us three to be living in the yurt in the woods. And I just thought, no. There's nothing in me that wants to do that. I don't think it's bad for other people. I just don't want to do it. It was like the pattern of my life definitely did not include that. So there we go. It was like I just knew that was just wasn't my myth. I was happy for it to be other people's myth, a myth of their life. That's what they want to do. Great. I had no interest in doing it for myself at all. So, and then interestingly, around that time, I had this really strong dream of the wheel of life where it came to me like that, with my face. Anyway, but I think it was interesting to me because I can definitely see my the sort of pattern emerging of what my life is. But I often see it by things I just don't want to do. I just know I don't want to do them. It's not a value judgment on anyone else doing them. I just don't want to do it. And what you see when you see a pattern emerging of your life is you see the sort of higher purpose to which your life, which makes your life meaningful. So you can talk about this as a sort of pattern of your life, but also the myth of your life. And within the myth of your life, there is imbued in the myth of your life a higher purpose, which could be the bodhicitta. That's the real higher purpose of your life. That's the pattern of your life, is somehow directing yourself towards cultivating the bodhicitta. So I'll try another way into it, because there's a Mahayana sutra called the Rashtrapala Pariprucha Sutra, just for your sutra scrabble. And it's got some really lovely stories. So one mustn't take the Mahayana sutras too literally. You think of them as visions or dreams. A very, very significant dreams. They're highly symbolic. And in the Rashtrapala Pariprucha Sutra, the gods come to Prince Punyarashmi. Punyarashmi in the middle of the night. So what happens is there's this wonderful prince who's very beautiful and very intelligent and lives in this palace, and he has everything that he wants, a bit like the Buddha did, everything that he wants. But at night, the gods come whisper in his ear and they say, basically, this is not for you. They start speaking to him of the sages of the past. They start speaking to him of the unsatisfactoriness of conditioned existence, the unsatisfactoriness of wives and palaces, of how all things are impermanent. They speak to him of the beauty of Buddhahood, of the beauty of the path to Buddhahood, telling him to renounce all things, to go to the forest, to find good friends to practice with, and to follow the path of the Buddhas of old. So I love this image, you know, there's him in the palace, and at night, everything's going on during the day, all his activities, as princely activities are. But at night, the gods start whispering to him of other things. And I sometimes think that's a bit like that in our lives. You know, we're going along ordinarily with our life, but at night, something whispers to us. And it whispers to us that our pattern is part of a greater pattern. So Bhante talks about it. He says, well, all our lives are part of the greater pattern of the Dharmakaya. What? The Dharmakaya, the... what does he say? The Dharmadhatu. Anyway, he sort of says, in a way, they're part of, in a way, if we're looking at this, they're all part of the bodhicitta, the bigger kind of project of the bodhicitta. And it's not to take this literally. It's not like we have all got a destiny written in the stars that's got to look like this. It's all planned out. It's not like that. It's more like a feeling that if we open ourselves up to something much bigger, part of much bigger potential. And it's significant to me in that sutra that it whispers it at night. It's like night is when something else happens. You know, we're beyond, maybe it's we're in that inner quiet. You know, we're beyond the ordinary preoccupations of the day. Something whispers to us of something more. And if we listen to that, we can see that within ourselves. The Buddha says, remember your inheritance. Remember that you're heirs to the Dharma, not heirs to material things. So yes, that in a way we belong to the spotless family of the Buddhas, not just our own family. And that's whispered to us at night or in meditation or in a puja. So it's about just listening to that voice. The bodhicitta is part of us, part of our patterning of our life. And what's true for us is also true of other people. So part of bodhicitta practice is also seeing the bodhicitta in others, the potential at least. In another Mahayana sutra, which you may be familiar with, the Vimalakirti Nidesha, you've got Vimalakirti, who's the sort of ultimate spiritual friend, if you like, who stops everyone settling down. And you've got a story with him and Purna. And Purna is the... is the sort of archetype, in this case, the archetypal Dharma teacher. Purna is a very interesting person in the Pali Canon, but that is another story. Turn away. Stay with it, yeah. Okay, so Vimalakirti Nidesha. So Purna is teaching a group of young monks the Dharma, but in quite a limited way, teaching them, well, the usual things, you know. Ethics, meditation, wisdom. And Vimalakirti rocks up and he says, do not put rotten food into a jewelled bowl. Do not put rotten food into a jewelled bowl. Do not expose those who admire the roar of a lion to the howl of a jackal. And he says, first of all, Purna, you've got to understand the inclination, the positive inclinations of these monks. So the positive inclinations here is a translation of ashaya. And ashaya is literally, I find it a very fascinating word, it's the foundation of all bodhicitta practice in the Vimalakirti Nidesha. All spiral paths in the Vimalakirti Nidesha start off with this quality, positive inclinations, ashaya. Without ashaya, there's no spiritual... no spiral path and no development. And with it, everything is possible. So it's important to know what it is. Mm-hmm. And what it is it's the sort of seat of feelings and thoughts, the mind, heart or soul. It's literally the vessel of the body or the stomach. So it's sort of that. It's your deepest motivations, your deepest disposition of mind and mode of thinking. So yes, so it's really motivation. And it's from a root which means wish, desire, hope and expectation. So it's your heart wish. Sometimes it's called the heart wish. Yeah, I'll put this on the board as well. And it's really beautiful quality, actually. So it's you can have a Kalyana Ashaya, a beautiful motivation or a beautiful intention, a beautiful wish. And it's said that it's like gold which won't corrode under stress or difficulty, or like a fire that keeps burning with a special kind of fuel. And it's a determination founded on faith, shraddha, and wise reflection, reflecting on the Dharma, Dharma Pachaya. So it's faith and reflection on the Dharma give rise to this purified, beautiful wish or motivation. And it's directed towards the qualities of the Buddha. as the high resolve to bring about the welfare and happiness of all beings. So it's that beautiful desire that one has just to help others and to work, turn towards Buddhahood. And Vimalakirti is asking Purana to remember that other people have those motivations. Everyone has this beautiful desire underneath all, underneath all the madness that we get into, is a beautiful desire to help other beings, to turn towards Buddhahood. In the way we would understand it in the Going for Refuge and Prostration practice, is that all beings go for refuge to the Three Jewels. And that's a vision, it's not a literal truth. It's not like my mum and dad have suddenly become Buddhists. But within their hearts, they have a beautiful motivation. And one has to sort of see that in them. Vimalakirti says, remember, understand that all that these young monks have the Kalyana Ashaya, the beautiful motivation, the beautiful heart wish. And then he goes into a meditation that causes the young monks to remember their own beautiful Ashaya, to contact again their own beautiful heart wish. And they remember that they've already developed the roots of skillfulness over lifetimes, and they already have the bodhicitta, and they've been serving Buddhas for many lifetimes. So it's, in a way, it's symbolic. It's trying to remember that actually there's a root of good in all beings. There's the heart of bodhicitta in all beings. And what we're trying to do when we teach the Dharma to people is help people to recall their roots of good, to remember their roots of good, to remember the bodhicitta within them. We're not trying to tell them they're deluded and we've got the answer. You know, that's not the point of Dharma practice. It's to remind people. It's to be, in a funny kind of way, I'm going somewhere with this, I'm not sure. Anyway, just to mix the Mahayana sutras here, it's a bit like we're the gods in the middle of the night. That's what a Dharma teacher is. They come in the middle of the night and they go, remember who you are. So, if we remember who we are, what's the meaning and purpose and the true beautiful heart wish in our own lives, we'll see that in ourselves and in others, and we'll naturally move towards it. We'll naturally move towards the bodhicitta. The bodhicitta will unfold in us by just remembering. You've just forgotten. That's all that's wrong. Mm-hmm. You're not a horrible person. You've just forgotten who you really are. Mm. Anyway. So yes, and then naturally the bodhicitta arises in that receptivity within our own being. But there's another myth as well. I'm sure you're wondering what I'm going to do to this beautiful diagram. Which is self-surrender. So in self-surrender, you kind of do that funny little stick man diagram. You just open yourself up and the bodhicitta comes to you. So there's an arrow from the big B to the little stick person. So yes, so in this particular myth, the bodhicitta is outside the five skandhas, which means that our usual experience is beyond our usual experience. Our usual experience is divided. It's in that kind of grasp and grasp dichotomy. And the bodhicitta is outside a divided consciousness. So what happens necessarily is that when you experience the bodhicitta arising, it feels like it's coming from outside of you. That's the common experience of people who, for whom the bodhicitta has arisen. It feels like it's not actually anything to do with you. Of course it's to do with you, because it arose in you. But actually it feels like it's completely different. It feels like you're part of something much bigger. It's not that you're excluded from that, or suppressed, or anything like that. It's just that there's something new has come into being, which feels discontinuous with our usual state of mind. So in this myth, what you have to do is you just surrender to it. There's this lovely lines from the Bodhicharyavatara where he says, I have no merit. I am completely destitute. I have nothing else to offer in worship. I give my entire self wholly to the conquerors. Take possession of me, sublime beings. Out of devotion, I am your slave. You take possession of me. I become fearless. I act for the benefit of beings. I leave behind previous wrongdoing completely. Never again shall I do another wrong. So, you know, in a way it's quite extreme language. I shall be your slave, take possession of me. And sometimes we can struggle with that as well. But what he's trying to describe is a mood. And the mood is, there is no way that in this deluded state of being, the bodhicitta is mine or going to arise in me. I just have to completely surrender towards the bodhicitta, take possession of me. When you take possession of me, then I can work for the benefit of all. So in the Rashtrapala Pariprecha Sutra, it doesn't end with the gods whispering. The gods whisper at night, and then Prince Punyarashmi goes into sort of solitary reflection and silence. And then what happens is his father, the king, creates a more heavenly palace, a more heavenly town, just for the enjoyment of the prince, Punyarashmi. Because he's worried about Punyarashmi, because Punyarashmi doesn't talk to anyone and is in this silent reflection. So the king decides that he's going to entice him out of this silent reflection with, I think I counted in the end, 8 million 16-year-old girls. A great big palace. Obviously, this is a man's vision. Anyway. So he creates this whole kind of, you know, heavenly palace, dancing girls, loads of friends who will be able to talk to him about interesting things, well-educated friends and musicians and all these things. And Punyarashmi is seriously not impressed. And he goes to the roof of the palace and he looks out in the sky, and the gods come and they start to talk about the Buddha. They start to talk about the Buddha that's living in Punyarashmi's own time. They start to rejoice in the Buddha's glossy hair, in his eyes like blue lotuses, in the Buddha's teeth which are as pure as snow, and his voice which is like the music of the gods, and his neck which is like a pure conch shell, with rounded shoulders and arms like iron bars, whose body is the colour of refined gold, and who walks with the sway of the Lord of Elephants, striding like a lion with the grace of a bull. So they start just rejoicing and rejoicing and rejoicing in the quality, the beautiful qualities of the Buddha. You know, how beautiful he is to look at, how beautiful it is to see him, how beautiful it is to hear him speak. And Punyarashmi is utterly delighted. He says, there is a Buddha and he's living at my time. And he's like this. That's so extraordinary. And he teaches this Dharma and he has this Sangha around him, which must be full of pure beings to want to renounce the world and to listen to such a beautiful person as the Buddha. They must be beautiful themselves. And he becomes full of kind of delight and enjoyment. And he just wants to leave the palace and leave this town and all the things that are provided for his enjoyment. He knows he can't leave by the door, so he decides to jump off the roof, metaphorically. And the Buddha, at this point, stretches out his hand and emits a ray of light which turns into a great white lotus flower made out of light. And Punyarashmi lands on the lotus flower and starts to be suffused. The lotus flower emits these rays and rays of pure white light which suffuses the body of Punyarashmi. Good. And then Punyarashmi supplicates the Buddha and he starts to praise the Buddha himself, delighting in the Buddha's body, in the Buddha's voice, in the beauty of Buddhahood. And then the story goes on that people wonder where Punyarashmi's got to, and then he shows everyone the Buddha, shows his father the king first of all, who's utterly overwhelmed by the beauty of the Buddha, starts rejoicing in the beauty of the Buddha, and all the dancing girls, the 16-year-olds and the friends and all the townspeople come They see the Buddha, they delight in the Buddha, they follow Punyarashmi, and it becomes a community of bodhisattvas. Wow. So they're not left out. So yeah, so this is not to be taken literally, and please don't throw yourself out the window thinking the Buddha's going to catch you. But I think what it's trying to say is something about there's a relationship between longing and beauty and surrender. You surrender to the goal of Buddhahood, you surrender to the bodhicitta, when it becomes so beautiful to you that it becomes utterly compelling. It's more compelling than external kind of objects of desire and samsara, conditioned existence. You have to give yourself to it utterly. You have to just let it take you over. And I suppose the question for self-surrender, the path to self-surrender, is how can one contact that beauty of bodhicitta in order to give oneself to it? And in the Buddhist tradition, we have so much. We have verses of praise to the bodhicitta, as we all know in the Bodhicharyavatara being an example of those verses. I've actually got a book, a Tibetan translation from the Tibetan of a whole, just hundreds of verses of praise to the bodhicitta. And I think, you know, in a way, that's what they do in Tibet. They just put verse after verse after verse after verse of the beauty of the bodhicitta. And we have the beauty of the bodhisattva figures, of Buddhahood in that of the bodhicitta in a kind of archetypal form. So beautiful, so compelling. And we have stories of bodhisattvas, you know, people like Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche or Dado Rinpoche, Minarepa, all these people who are bodhisattvas, where we read them and we think, how extraordinary, and we just want to surrender to that ideal. Mad though it is, you know, here am I, a miserable, deluded wretch, and yet I see something of such majesty. There's a really beautiful poem about love written by Czesław Miłosz, who's a Polish poet, and he wrote it in Warsaw in the Second World War, which is a place that must have been very difficult to see what love is at times. And he says, he ends that poem about love, and he says, it doesn't matter whether he knows what he serves. Who serves best doesn't always understand. And I think about that with the bodhicitta. One can't understand the bodhicitta. How could we understand the bodhicitta? We're deluded. You know, we're caught in this suffering of confusion, of not understanding ourselves, of creating our own suffering all the time. We're not going to understand what the bodhicitta is, and yet we can surrender to it. And yet it's so beautiful. It's such a sublime ideal that one could just, in a fit of madness, devote one's whole life to it. Right. So yeah, so we've got these three myths and ways of developing the bodhicitta, and you know, they're not really separate myths. It's not like you really choose one or the other, because they're all working with this fundamental development of wisdom and compassion. They're all developing these kind of moods or motivations or trends. And they're all qualities of the bodhicitta. Renunciation and faith, and letting go of self-clinging, and seeing into a more beautiful possibility, not just for myself, but for all beings. So I'll just end by a very beautiful verse about the bodhicitta from Jigme Lingpa, who's a Tibetan teacher, I think, of the 18th century. Mesmerized by the sheer variety of perceptions, which are like the illusory reflections of the moon in water, beings wander endlessly astray in samsara's vicious cycle. In order that they might find comfort and ease in the luminosity and all-pervading space of the nature of their minds, I generate the limitless love, limitless compassion, limitless joy and limitless equanimity of the awakened mind, the heart of bodhicitta. I'll read that again. Mesmerized by the sheer variety of perceptions, which are like the illusory reflections of the moon and water, beings wander endlessly astray in samsara's vicious cycle. in order that they may find comfort and ease in the luminosity and all-pervading space of the nature of their minds. I generate the limitless love, limitless compassion, limitless joy and limitless equanimity of the awakened mind, the heart of Bodhicitta.